This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. And today, I'm bringing you some unusual objects and some equally unusual prices paid. We'll have a look at a book which was once very controversial, which would excite, and the question was, would it pervert? We look at another book which will excite but won't pervert, and we look at deceit and deception and fairy tales, some collectibles, some trivia, which may not be all that trivial, and we'll look at what's on, where you can go, and what you can do. Not necessarily all in that order. Do you collect books, or do you read them? Or do you read them and collect them, or collect them without reading them? In any case, have you read Lady Chatterley's Lover? I bought a paperback copy of this many years ago and got into a bit of trouble for it. Let's read a bit more about some of the trouble the book had. And this piece comes from page 38 of the Antiques Trade Gazette of 17th of November. Would you let your servant read this? The very Penguin copy of D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover, used by Sir Lawrence Byrne, the presiding judge in the famous 1960 obscenity trial, has sold for £45,000. That's very approximately $81,000 Australian dollars. It formed part of the eclectic mix of paintings, books, and a great many curious objects that made up a sale titled Private View on November the 1st at Sotheby's. It was Sir Lawrence who famously asked for the jury, would you approve of your young sons, young daughters, because girls can read as well as boys, reading this book? Is it a book that you would have lying around in your own house? Is it a book you would even wish your wife or your servants to read? In fact, it was Lady Byrne who read through the novel for her husband and marked up the sexually explicit passages, and she was also understood to have stitched the damask bag in which this famous copy and notes on Central Criminal Court stationery still reside. The defence called 35 eminent literary and academic figures, among them E.M. Forster, Richard Hoggart, and Rebecca West, to give the opinion on Lawrence's artistry, intentions, and treatment of sex, and the jury took just 3 hours to return a not guilty verdict. Mr. Justice Byrne's summing up had been fair, but his private views were almost certainly glimpsed in his refusal to award costs, noted the Sotheby's cataloguer, leaving the defendants with a substantial legal bill. When last seen at auction in 1993, this famous copy had sold for £3,800. And now a very different sort of book. What do maces mean to you? Medieval battle? Well, not all maces were designed to kill. And here we have a book, Ceremonial Maces of Australian Universities by Christine Errett. And this appears in the newsletter from October 2018 of the Silver Society of Australia. Christine Errett has provided an in-depth study of 40 ceremonial maces of Australian universities. There's a full description of each mace accompanied by colour photographs. Other details include the dates of presentation, the benefactors, the designers and makers. The introduction includes historical notes about maces and relevant facts about Australian universities and the pertinence of ceremonial maces. Their construction and uniqueness are discussed, as is their symbolism in design. A map is included of the locations of the main campuses of the universities. Precious metals traditionally used in ceremonial maces in the past are incorporated in 35 of the maces. Much use is made of materials local and pertinent to the individual universities, such as locally sourced gemstones and wood. There can be a great disparity in the number of years between the inauguration of university and the gaining of a ceremonial mace. Individual lengths vary considerably, ranging from 61 centimetres to 200 centimetres, with the average being about 122 centimetres. Similarly, weights vary, with the average being between 2 and 6 kilograms. Christine Errett wrote that the breakaway in design from the traditional British style of ancient mace, as used in 1854 for the University of Sydney in the fledgling British colony, has enabled Australian universities to express their own individualism and uniqueness. And the many artist craftsmen involved in their making have revealed their ingenious design skills as well as their expert craftsmanship. Christine has been able to view, handle and photograph a significant number of the maces during her research and has been able to supply some universities with a range of photographs which she had taken to fill a shortfall of photographs held in their archives. Christine is to be sincerely congratulated on the detailed information which has come from her continuing research and is included in this publication. The research is a comprehensive study of all ceremonial maces of Australian universities made in both Australia and England. Christine also pointed out that her distinguished husband, Ron Errett, was to be thanked for his wise counsel and that his role as a proofreader was demanding and fulfilled with his usual patience and diligence. The publication is essential for all Silver Society members. The wonderful book of 56 pages contains 138 colour images and detailed descriptions of each of the 40 maces, information on benefactors, designers and makers. This awe-inspiring book is available for free postage within Australia for only $30 from www.parkerpressbooks.com.au. And that was the review of Ceremonial Maces of Australian Universities, written by Christine Errett, reviewed by Patrick Street on page 11 of the Silver Society of Australia's newsletter. And the Silver Society can be found on www.silversociety.com.au. From books, let's go to a piece of furniture. Let's go to a dining room table. This is a very special one. Do you remember the Spanish Armada in 1588, which came over to invade England? And Francis Drake, who was far too busy playing bowls, successfully made it impossible for the Spaniards to land, and they had to go up the coast of England and around Scotland. All the time they were fended off from landing, and they went around the coast of Ireland, and many of their galleons perished. And that's the beginning of our story here, because this is a table that relates to that story very closely. This story comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 27th of October on page 11. Armada table sails to €360,000 result. And that's approximately $575,000, which is a lot for a dining room table. A table created from wood and sculptural elements from a Spanish Armada galleon shipwrecked off Ireland's west coast 430 years ago has sold for €360,000, that's £316,800, plus 20% buyer's premium plus VAT, at Auction House Adams on October the 15th. The Armada table, as it's known, is one of the best documented pieces of 16th century furniture in Ireland. It was estimated at €100,000 to €200,000. It sold to a phone bidder at Dublin-based Adams Decorative Arts Sale, held at Georgian stately home Townley Hall in Drogheda. Adams confirmed to ATG that the table will stay in Ireland. The galleon, part of the Spanish Armada defeated by Elizabeth I's forces in 1588, must have foundered, like many others, off the hazardous coast of Doonbeg, County Clare, as it tried to return to Spain. Clare's high sheriff of the time, Boethius Clancy, rescued part of the ship and its decorative carvings and had them made into a grand refectory table. Housed in Drumoland Castle for 300 years, the table last resided at Bunratty's Castle in County Clare, and at 7 foot 11 inches, that's 2.4 metres, in length, and 3 feet, 91 centimetres, wide, had to be removed for auction by crane. The table's owner, Lord Inchquin of Drumoland Castle, said he was selling it for financial reasons. Desmond Fitzgerald, 1937-2011, the Knight of Glyn and authority of Irish furniture historian, once described the Armada table as one of the most important and earliest pieces of Irish furniture. Its sale attracted controversy as it was a key attraction at Bunratty, and there were calls to save the table for the nation. And that was written by Noel McKellerton, and it was on page 11 of the Antique Trades Gazette on the 27th of October 2018. And that's a very good way to host a very, very expensive dinner party. Over $500,000 Australian just for the table you eat off. Let's move now from dining room tables to paintings. And we'll stay back in history, but we'll come nearer to our current time by 80 years, and we'll come to just after the middle of the 17th century. I'd like to tell you about a very special painting, and for a very special reason. The mood of the painting is perhaps like that of opening the door of a teenager's bedroom. Inside is a cluttered, jumbled insight into the teenager's world of what is important, useful, enjoyable, iconic, or just valued. Our painting does something similar, but for a very rich family in the mid-17th century, and their collection of treasures, curiosities, and rarities. Let me explain. The painting lives in the splendid Norwich Castle Museum and Art Gallery in Norfolk, England. That's just less than 2 hours in the train going northeast from London. It's a still-life oil in a carved wooden frame measuring 165 centimetres by 146.5 centimetres. It was commissioned by the wealthy Rags to Riches, and then back to Rags, Paston family, spelt P-A-S-T-O-N, in the 1660s. It was to show off a small part of their enormous collection. This was shortly before they went into decline, and those items in the painting and numerous other items in the collection were subsequently sold off to pay debts. As we look at the picture, beneath a drapery canopy, there is a seemingly jumbled confusion of silver and gold objects, mounted shells, a trumpet, a lute, a clock, an hourglass, globe, monkey, parrot, some fruit, even a lobster, an African boy and a young girl. What do we make of all that? There are many layers and interpretations which were explored in great detail in an exhibition held in the Castle Museum from June to September 2018. The catalogue was entitled The Paston Treasure, Riches and Rarities of the Known World. The exhibition reunited the picture with many of the dispersed items depicted in it and other items in the collection. The painting is a still life, but with a difference. It's not the more familiar vase of flowers or an abandoned table setting. The strange mixture of items reminds the viewer both of worldly wealth and unavoidable mortality with the passing of time. Such a painting is described as a vanitas still life. At the end of this broadcast, do go to 2RPH website at www.2rph.org.au and look up the Antiques Radio Show. You'll see we've used this fascinating, splendid picture as our banner. We've heard about some interesting objects, but where do we learn more about things like those? Well, here are a couple of ideas. The November issue of the Art newspaper has a very good section on what's on, not only in Australia, but around the world. But for our purposes, let's think of Australia. Sydney, the Art Gallery of New South Wales. An excellent exhibition, Masters of Modern Art from the Hermitage. And that goes on until the 3rd of March 2019. And the Hermitage, or Hermitage, is that absolutely splendiferous museum in St. Petersburg in Russia, which is certainly well worth a visit if you actually can get that far. But if you can't, then go to the Art Gallery of New South Wales. If you don't want to go to a museum, how about joining a society? There are many in Sydney covering all sorts of different disciplines, areas, and topics for collection. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about the Ceramic Society. They meet on Sydney's North Shore, and let me give you an example of two of the lectures they've got coming up, and you get some idea of what they get up to. On the 25th of February 2019, Les Peterkin is giving a lecture on tin glazed ceramics in Europe and the Middle East. And on the 29th of April, Ian Clark gives a talk on Chinese ceramics and Sydney, a history. And if you want to learn more about that, you can go to their website, www.ceramicscollectors.org.au. That's all lowercase, ceramiccollectors.org.au. What do you do if you actually want to buy something? You don't just want to learn, but you want to buy. Well, there are all sorts of shops and auctions, but there are also antiques and collectibles, fairs and events. And here are a couple which aren't too far away from Sydney. From the 6th to the 17th of February in 2019, there's the Hunter Valley Antiques and Collectibles Fair. And from the 22nd to 24th of February 2019, the Armadale Antiques and Collectibles Fair. They may be a little bit of a drive out of Sydney, but you might find it well worthwhile, even if you don't find an Armada table or a Paston Treasure painting. And there's an excellent website, antiquesreporter.com.au. That's all one word, antiquesreporter.com.au. And that will tell you all about upcoming fairs and events. We've mentioned museums in England, in particular in Norwich, and they are a very important part of our cultural heritage, a good way we can learn about ourselves, where we've come from and where we're going, etc. Let's have a look at a particular museum in Sydney, the Powerhouse Museum, which is the subject of moves to move it from where it is at the moment, very close to the city centre, out to Parramatta. And here is an article that appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald on the 6th of December on page 18. And Linda Morris writes, "Powerhouse edges towards heritage list." The final step towards state heritage listing of the original Ultimo Powerhouse will begin next year after pressure from the National Trust, which has described 3 years of inaction after the building's nomination as inexplicable. But there are no plans to give heritage protection to the Powerhouse Museum's Sulman award-winning domed extension, which constitutes the museum's entry hall. And the Office of Environment and Heritage says any subsequent heritage protections imposed on the historic powerhouse and its interiors won't impede government plans to either sell the site or relocate the museum to Parramatta. Construction of the powerhouse began in 1888, and it became the first large state-owned electricity generating station in New South Wales and original station for the supply of power to Sydney's tram network. While listed on the Australian Institute of Architects Register of Significant Architecture in New South Wales, it was not awarded state heritage listing due to what the Trust's Chief Executive Officer Debbie Nils called a procedural anomaly. In a letter to the New South Wales Heritage Council dated November the 5th, Ms. Nils said it was vital that the powerhouse be given the recognition it clearly merits and the protection of the New South Wales Heritage Act through any future development. The Trust has also advocated for the protection of Willow Grove in Parramatta, which may be demolished to make way for the new museum. Graham Quint, National Trust New South Wales Conservation Director, said, "Due to its heritage significance, the powerhouse building requires the protection of the New South Wales Heritage Act prior to any development proposals. When it was first adapted, it was considered to be in good hands, so state listing was never regarded as urgent. It is now. The National Trust New South Wales finds the continued delay in proceeding with the nomination to be inexplicable. In March 2016, the State Heritage Register Committee recommended that the potential industrial heritage significance of the powerhouse be investigated for listing, according to minutes obtained by the Herald. But research for the powerhouse has yet to start. The Office of Environment and Heritage said it will begin it next year as part of its 2019 listing programme of works. State heritage listing will not impede or alter the potential sale or reuse of a building, and adaptive reuse is actively encouraged to ensure our state's heritage is not mothballed, but open and accessible to the people of New South Wales and Australia to enjoy and appreciate, a department spokesperson said. Lionel Glendenning, the government architect responsible for the 1988 award-winning museum design, said the heritage response was erroneous and lacked any understanding of the literature and history or construction of its place on the edge of the CBD. It's a deliberate delaying tactic used by this government to justify their ridiculous and destructive move of one of Sydney's earliest and formative cultural institutions and one of the few applied arts and sciences museum in the world, he said. And that was Linda Morris writing on page 18 of the Sydney Morning Herald on the 6th of December, Powerhouse Edges Towards Heritage List. And let's move from bricks and mortar and concrete and museums to fairy tales. We all know what a fairy is, but are there any at the bottom of your garden? Now here's a little tale, and it goes something like this. Two young girls, I think they were cousins, were playing in the bottom of their garden in 1917, and they were late for afternoon tea. And to avoid a scolding, they invented a story about there being fairies at the bottom of the garden. This was laughed at, but they decided to produce the evidence, and let's see who actually believed them. And this report comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 20th of October, and it is a report about an auction of books and works on paper. And it's titled, The Story of a Real Fairy Tale. It may seem hard to credit nowadays, but photographs of fairies at the bottom of the Cottingley, in Yorkshire, garden of two young girls, produced in 1917 as a practical joke, were taken to be genuine by many people, most famously Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. In truth, the photographs were the work of Frances Griffiths and her cousin Elsie Wright, and the fairies were cut-out figures secured in the ground with hatpins. The Cottingley fairies were the subject of much bizarre public discussion, and even what was in fact the head of a hatpin being used in one figure's stomach to keep it standing was pointed out. Conan Doyle concluded that it was in fact the figure's navel, sparking a discussion on methods of birth in the fairy kingdom. Rather than damage the public reputations of those who professed to believe their photographs genuine, the girls kept quiet about their true origin and their own involvement until the 1980s. In a Dominic Winter auction sale of October the 4th, the photograph of Frances with the fairies dancing before her was sold for £15,000, while another of Elsie with a dancing gnome made £5,400. In the printed captions on the mounts, Frances is called Alice by Conan Doyle, who wished to conceal the girls' true identities, and Elsie became Iris. And that's the story of the fairies at the bottom of the garden, the Cottingley fairies, and appeared in the Antique Trade Gazette on the 20th of October. We'll move now from fairies and fantasy to trivia. But it may not be quite as trivial as it sounds. Hash. Have you ever wondered about the hash button on your phone or on your computer keyboard? And what about hashtags? All are denoted by the symbol of crossed lines, intersecting more or less vertically and horizontally. Did you know this symbol is found in heraldry and on coats of arms going back to the Middle Ages? In battle, colourful insignia on shields and on clothing helped you know who the enemy was, who you should kill, or who might try to kill you. Coats of arms were also used as a symbol of ownership or identification. They could be found on furnishings, in paintings, books, or painted onto surfaces. But what if colour could not be used? What if a coat of arms was carved onto a wooden chair, or a gravestone, or represented in metal on a gate? In these situations, special symbols were used to denote the different colours. A series of dots equaled the colour gold. Vertical lines equaled the colour red, horizontal lines equaled blue, and intersecting vertical and horizontal lines equals black. Does this ring any bells? This process of depicting colours by means of lines and dots is called hatching, and the intersecting vertical and horizontal lines for black are sometimes called cross-hatching. And guess what? They look remarkably similar to the so-called hash symbol. More accurately, we should perhaps call it the black button on your phone, or black key on the keyboard. And how about black tag me too? So, a hash, as in tag, has been hatched, or hashed out of, the word hatch. And finally, what do you think the most expensive piece of celebrity clothing ever sold was? And we have a piece here from www.news.artnet of November the 28th, 2018, entitled, From the Priciest Painting to the Richest Wine Bottle, Here are the Most Expensive Objects Ever Sold at Auction. And we go for the piece of celebrity clothing, and it is Marilyn Monroe's subway dress. Price, $5.5 million. That's approximately $7.5 million Australian dollars. When? June 2011. Where? Profiles in History, Beverly Hills. Why? The ivory pleated cocktail dress was designed by Hollywood costumer William Travilla for Billy Wilder's 1955 film The Seven-Year Itch. The frock is arguably one of the most expensive garments in cinematic history, forever tied to the image of Marilyn Monroe struggling to cover herself while perched atop a subway grate. The dress was previously owned by actress Debbie Reynolds and featured as a marquee item in a Hollywood memorabilia-themed auction at the California-based Profiles in History auction house. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.